This is a Pinball News production.
The whole premise of this is, the few talks that I've done over the years, and there was a period of time where I didn't do any, as Josh said, my son, I've always tended to kind of wing it. I don't have anything that's prepared. I know most of the guys that come and do talks have everything prepared. They have slides. They have all sorts of stuff. And when I mentioned to Dave about the possibility, depending on how I felt, to actually uncover and unearth some of my stuff, I started putting things together. And wanted to just share, because I have never, ever talked about it, really the untold story of the pinball book. And I'm assuming that most people are aware of the book, other than what Dave just held up. So, published in 1977. It is a 40th anniversary, basically. I mean, I kind of started in 1974 doing some research, teaming up with James Hamilton. We kind of got teamed up because he was brought in for a feature that ultimately appeared in GQ in the winter issue of 1975. And with lead times and everything else, that's how that stuff kind of worked. But anyway, to get to the basic of everything, and I've said this on a couple of occasions, and I know that I'm pressed for time. Sorry, Rob, I know that I'm long-winded, so you guys will forgive me if we can't get through everything I wanted to, then maybe next year or the year after if I'm still alive. I wanted a pinball machine. I mean, that's the whole premise. That's the whole reason that I am actually sitting here in front of you, and all the things that I've achieved over the years is based on one pure and simple fact: I wanted a game. And we won't have to get into those details unless we even have a couple of moments for Q&A. So being at that time the associate editor of GQ, I basically assigned myself to do a story on pinball with the assumption that I would get to meet various people and find out how to buy a game, because I didn't have a clue. I was in New York City. And I went to the library to start doing some research. This is the very first step in what ultimately became the book. And went into the stacks and looked up everything that I could think of after pinball showed up. Nothing. Flippers, tilt, I mean, you name it. The only thing that I found and uncovered was in 1972, there was a piece done by Tony Lucas in Esquire magazine. And for those who are collectors and enthusiasts of pinball, if you remember back 30 now plus years ago, the most revered game at that time was Fireball. I'll do compliments to Jim Patlin and the other guys who worked on it, but Fireball was a featured game in GQ, which is why it reached such heights. Not a knock on it, but it wasn't necessarily the best game that they had done, and so on, but again, it had the notoriety. When I went back to the editor to say that it was going to be a little bit more difficult because I couldn't find any books on the subject, he just offhandedly said, well, you think you know so much, why don't you write a book? And he laughed, and I laughed, and I went back to my desk and thought about it for a little bit, and I had a copy editor that I had hired, and he said, you know, you should write a book. My sister was living in New York City. She had been working with Simon & Schuster, CBS News, and other things, and she knew some people because I didn't in publishing, and my first meeting was set up with a company called Chelsea House Publishing. They were about on 40th off of Fifth Avenue in New York. And I was all set to go to sit down and talk to the editor-in-chief of this publishing company. And Peter Simon, my copy editor, came in and said, what are you taking? I was, taking what? Don't you have those? And I apologize in advance. I'm not trying to be politically incorrect. You have to understand what GQ was back then. Anyway. He said, don't you have some of those pretty pictures and flyers and things and whatever? And it was because I had collected a few of those. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you have to do something else. And I amazingly found what I had typed up to take to sell a book idea. And what I had done, the title of the book, I'll be blind to you guys, but not blind to what I have, The Great American Pinball Machine. That was the original anticipated title. Introduction and History of Pinball Machines, Evolution of the Pinball Machine, Bagatelle, Non-Electric Pin Games, pinball games, crossover into electronics, technological advances, industry standardization. Number three, psychological aspects of pinball machines, creative concepts behind the pinball machine, time limit effect, reward gratification of pinball, skill versus risk factor in design. Point two, the great pinball game itself, pictures and facts, the pinball machine, a look at individual games, strategy involved to succeed, overview of the odds, whatever that meant. Number three, the future of pinball machines and the video electronic boom. And then I had my little handwritten notes. I did this in like 10 minutes. I mean, my meeting, let's say my meeting was like at 12. I'm doing this at like 11:15, knowing I have about a half hour to walk over to the place because I am freaked out from what Peter has told me. Interviews of the major people in the industry, different arcades in the world, foreign market, decade-by-decade breakdown, how to play best games. That's what I sat down and talked to the editor about, and I wish I remembered his name. I don't. Showed some pinball flyers that I had picked up from one of the local distributors over on 8th Avenue and 42nd, 43rd Street in New York City. We sat and talked for about 45 minutes. And I walked out of there with a contract for a book. Okay, now what do I do? And I called my sister. And my sister knew an attorney who took care of creative people, whether they were musicians, authors, artists, or whatever else. I set up a meeting like 2 days later, went in to meet with this person and said, here, I have a contract from Chelsea House Publishing to do a book on pinball, history and whatever else. And the premise, and Jim Schulberg will appreciate this, the premise for the book, for any of you who are somewhat familiar with Groucho Marx, was there was a book that came out around that time called the Marx Brothers Scrapbook. The beauty of that oversized cocktail table book was that it was the history of the brothers told in interview fashion with pictures and what have you. That's what the premise was here. I wanted to really personalize what the games were all about. I just didn't want to do reprints of flyers or whatever else. And at that point in time, James and I had already done some pictorials, if you will, on games. We've gone to a trade show. But anyway, I'm going past, sorry, because I feel this urgency of time. So I sat down with the attorney, and we kind of went through the contract. I'm going to be very honest about it. And we got to the point where there was the financials, and he said, they're offering you a $5,000 advance. Is that enough? And I was like, I don't know. I don't think so. He said, well, you know, everything else looks pretty good. You know, you should probably get an agent. Okay. So I went around to various folks. And in the meantime, I was also reaching out to other publishers, Grosset and Dunlap. I could not find it. Maybe at some point in time the boys will after I'm long gone and they'll go through my copious archives. Wow. I heard a voice that I kind of know. What a surprise. Thanks, Joshy. We had done a mock-up, oversized pictures that Jim and I had taken, just going to various arcades and things. And Grosset and Dunlap took that to the book fair in Nuremberg, Germany. It was an annual thing back then. It was huge. They came back. They were very excited, wanted to do things. So Chelsea House is over here waiting. I have finally gotten an agent who's like, okay. And had talked to Doubleday Books, for those who are familiar with Ed Trapunsky's book. They wanted me to do two books. One would be a small little paperback with pictures. Another one would just be text only. No, I don't want to do it that way. Finally and ultimately, E.P. Dutton enters into the scene. Bob Whitehead, geez, was the editor on the project. They got it. I wanted to do an oversized book. And the oversized book, sorry, Martin, I'm moving. Bear with me for a minute. I need to find where the pages are. The oversized book had to fit the contours of an entire playfield, right? Couldn't be square, had to be long. This is an irregular sized book. E.P. Dutton had never really done basic cocktail table books. This was going to be their first venture into doing cocktail table books.
Keep talking.
So that was one of the most important parts for me. The other part, obviously, it's pinball. I need color. Need you to buy into color. We agreed, got a contract, agent and the attorney went through everything, so we're now in early part of 1976. The first trade show that I had gone to with James was actually a Florida State show. There's some pictures in the book of a little girl playing duck hunt or something with a gun. That was at that show. It was the first time I got a chance to meet Nolan Bushnell. They were just kind of really kind of getting launched, if you will, during that time frame. This is really kind of in the infancy. The GQ piece, James knew a fellow by the name of George Delmerico. George was the art director at the New York Times, specifically their arts and leisure section. So George came on, so now we have three people. And George thought, God, wouldn't it be a great idea to do a piece in New York Times? Dave somehow found it. It's blown up somewhere. Forget about whatever the prices are that are quoted. So the Arts and Leisure section, December of 1975, that appears, and I am suddenly on my way. And we won't get into the court case or anything else. So during the course of events with the book, 3 years, traveling with Jim around Europe, the advance did not cover all the expense, obviously, let alone for the film. I think Dave may have mentioned over 5,000 pictures taken. I have brought you about 80 slides that have never been seen, some that didn't make the final cut for the book for a variety of reasons, and some that I just thought would be kind of interesting to see. Oh, do you have a little clicky thing? All right, so I am in Champaign, Illinois. Dear friend of mine was a professor down there. I knew that they had pinball machines, and one of the first trips that we took was down to Champaign to stay at my friend Mickey's place, and Mickey was working for the local TV station. And he said, hey, you want to do an interview? They have a show and whatever else, and you can talk about the fact that you're working on a pinball book. So here I am outside the studio, click. A little bit more of a close-up because, of course, God, look at that person. Go, another one. Thank you. There I am on air. And yes, I was wearing saddle shoes back then before even Woody Allen was. Go. He was whoever the host was for the show. Great people. I mean, here I am, you know, doing this on local TV, talking about the fact that I've begun working on putting together a pictorial history of pinball. Here's another scene of us. Go ahead. I like his hair even more than mine. Keep going. I, of course, am animated. And just to show you the backdrop, I mean, we're talking, I think it was called The Morning Cup was what the show was. So again, this is my first exposure to being on air. Go. All right. So before we get into this, what I need to have everybody understand is that this book that is finished and published, I don't like. It's not the book that I wrote. The first manuscript that I turned in was about 380 pages. The manuscript for that, and I brought it, I don't know if any of you have ever seen a galley proof. This is the book. And you go through this just to make sure that punctuation is right and whatever else. What I didn't pick up on at the tail end, because at that time I was now managing editor of GQ, I was down in Puerto Rico for our editorial sales conference. I've always talked at length about the fact that my listing of games in the back was complete up to that point in time. Well, they edited it because it wasn't running on the page. It's kind of like going and doing a dictionary and you get to the A's and suddenly it's like, Axel, we didn't have, just take that out. We'll make it work somewhere else. So there were some things that were done that didn't thrill me. The other part to the equation, people have never asked me, but I'm going to talk about it right this second for a couple of moments. They've asked who Carl Dessens and Clark Welton were. I had an editor who changed his mind midstream. I brought in a book with, you probably are reading, for any of you who have seen the book, you're probably seeing about 30% of the interviews for any of the folks. From Alvin Gottlieb on through to Sam Ginsberg, Bill Gerr, Steve Kordak, Norm Clark, the list goes on and on, Jim Patla, Dave Christensen. They thought it was a little bit too heavy, a little bit too long, that we don't need to have all this stuff. Need to shorten it. I've written a number of different books over the years. I also had aspirations to write some serious stuff which has yet to happen for a number of reasons. But I wound up sitting down with my agent to just say, I don't want to do this anymore. I mean, we've hit a point where I had this dream, this vision, this is what we're working toward. We've just traveled literally throughout all of Europe, around the United States, compiled all this stuff, have met with some remarkable individuals, have had literally tens of thousands of words transcribed from all the lengthy interviews that I did. They want to cut everything back and change it to something. They basically want to, you know, strip it all away. And she just asked me a question. She said, do you want to do any more writing? Do you want to do any books ever again in your life? Seriously?
Literally.
If you ever want to do any writing ever again, then you have to accept what they're going to do, because if you back out and walk away from this project, even if they're wrong and you're right, no other publisher will ever work with you. There'll be a stain on you forever. So you go back and you think through all of the work, all the promises. God, I do get emotional. Wow. I had an obligation to bring all these people to life. The hours that were spent, arms that were open to me, from Harry Williams on through, I mean, some incredible people. I don't want to let them down. So I bit down hard and said, okay, we'll try to make the best of it. And in the process, they brought in Carl first to rework the manuscript. I would have final approval, kind of, but Carl was going to take it over. I think Carl worked on it for about 2 months, gave up, threw up his hands in the air and said no, because I tend to be, and Josh can probably bear it, I tend to be somewhat of a control freak. Yeah. So they brought in Clark. Clark was more understanding. I told him exactly what was going on, what I wanted to fight for, what was important to me. And I didn't want it to just be high. And after the fifth ball that he plays, I mean, they had come up with something where, if you're familiar with the book, in the beginning it kind of opens up, which was kind of my opening anyway, I play a ball. And then I get into the game. They wanted to do it like, you're playing all along and we'll just intersperse other stuff and we'll have the pictures. And it's like, no freaking way is that going to happen. So Clark kind of kowtowed to me in a way. I think that the editor finally threw up his hands because effectively, as I said, they kind of cut off the majority of the stuff. We kind of left the heart and soul in as best as we could and as best as I could with the constraints. So again, the point that I wanted to bring up is the journey to bring that to life was not as simple as many people might have believed, and the fact that it almost didn't happen, it was a very real reality. So again, it's something I've never ever shared. I've never talked about it. I've looked at the book from time to time over the last 40 years. My preference, and I do have it, is to read my own original manuscript. It's much more innocent. I know that it probably needs a lot of editing, now especially in the time that's passed. But the core of it, the essence of it, the personalities that come through from the people that I talk to, that had meaning for me. A lot of the collectors, Sam Bergman and others come to mind, Pat Hamlet, and the time that he spent opening up his place. There were lengthy interviews that were just chopped. These people are kind of insignificant. This is a material story. I mean, more personal things in terms of Harry and what was going on in his life. Harry Williams, Steve Kordak, Norm DeSelm, Gordon Horlick. I mean, people that aren't even in the book just got lopped off. So, again, wanted to share that with everybody so that you have hopefully a better understanding and appreciation of what ultimately came out. And I'm gratified. I am humbled. That the book has endured for so long. I think that James's photography was just sensational. The interesting part with that, there's 9 basic shapes of photographs in the book. The best printer of color books back then was a Japanese publisher called Dai Nippon. Well, they're doing it in Japan. There's a language barrier, so we came up with a system with George, James, and myself to kind of note what the things were. And in a world, you don't have to click yet, in a world of slides back then, because James did everything in slides through 35 millimeter, we set up a sheet in James's studio apartment, and we did the sizing just right, and we clicked through to see, all right, this is going to be number 9, this is a 7. So everything was put in different pouches so that they knew exactly where it was, and then when they were laying everything out, it worked that way. The pinball cover, another little-known fact. We actually created this as a back glass. It doesn't come out because the color is a little bit too intense, but James, George, and I had designed what I wanted, and we basically backlit that, and then James took a picture of it. So that became the cover. And in the world of publishing, you wind up getting color proofs. This is one of about 10 that exist in the entire world. This is a first batch of color proofs, and if Rob doesn't mind, I would like to make a donation for the auction. So that is for you. So again, that's kind of the story of the book. I want to go through some slides. I did not get to Europe. I wanted to give you a sense of things. Gottlieb, D. Gottlieb and Company had just moved into Northlake from where they had been. I think the facility had been open for less than a year, and it was where I met Alvin Gottlieb for the first time. And I walked in. This was basically their lobby area. And the interesting part was Alvin's brother-in-law, Judd Weinberg, who I think was here a couple of years ago at Expo, was playing when I walked in and turned and walked away. Didn't want anybody to see him or anything else. But anyway, that's Gottlieb. Go. Chicago Coin Machine. Sam Ginsberg's place. Again, a place that was on Diversey, I think. A little bit west. Everybody was in the same pocket and area. For those who have been in and around Chicago, where Williams is, at California Avenue, which used to be United. The Bally factory and facility was on Belmont, literally like almost kitty corner. Thought that this would be kind of interesting. Again, Chicago Coin, their first electrically operated pin game in 1935. Oh, and the fellow on the left of that, if you want to go back one, I believe that that might have actually been Wayne Nyans, who was looking at that on display somewhere, but anyway. Go. Bally Manufacturing, which I was just mentioning, that was the place. That's where everything was happening back during that period of time. Next. All right, Jim, what game? Thank you. So
I was more interested in the Rolls Royce in the previous slide, but that was a birthday gift for Gold.
Was that a birthday gift for him? Thank you. So back then, and again, in terms of my journey, I had the unique opportunity of having access to all the companies, behind all the doors and everything else. This is a Whitewood. I wound up playing it. I have a feeling, and maybe somebody knows what this game is, it looks like freedom to me.
So, before they got rid of the pop-up or down, they changed.
Well, they had to because of Hans Rosenzweig saying it has to be an Italian bottom, otherwise I'm not going to take X number of containers. So again, and that's a whole other story, left better for another time. So just wanted to share with you, this is a Whitewood. Here it is again with a ball in play, and that's with James doing the photography and me playing next. I think that picture is one of the outtakes from the Norm Clark picture in the book, and then there's another one. There's Norm looking up, just a marvelous guy. Next. Steve Kordak at a leisurely moment. During the times when we were out visiting, taking pictures and whatever else, I thought people would like to see Steve yet again. Just a remarkable fellow. Grand Prix. The interesting part with this, and you can't tell it here, I guess I was the only person from the outside world when they were looking at switching over to solid state. There were three different systems that Williams had developed, and Steve got me off the show floor. There was the MOA convention that used to be in the Hilton downtown in Chicago. And he said, come in a cab. Come up with me. I want to show you something. And I want to get your feedback. So I gave him my feedback as to what I liked and whatever else, and the net result ultimately was that they switched over to solid state, and there's a whole story about how all of that happened as well, but next. Oh, who's the young fellow in the vest? I wonder. Yeah, Gary Gayton is one, but who's the guy just to the right of him? And then there's a fellow with a burgundy sport coat on behind that may or may not look like Greg Kamik. So here you go, another point in time. Just wanted to show some candids. Go. All right, this is interesting, and then there's a series of about four pictures. So around the time of my book, and I need to backtrack for 1 second. How many of you are familiar with the name Steve Kirk? Very talented, kind of deranged designer. Worked for a while with Gottlieb, worked for a while with almost everybody. If you take a look at Buffy out there, that's a redo of his Swords of Fury that Williams wound up doing. Tom Snyder had a late show called Tomorrow, I think, that came up after Johnny Carson. And pinball was getting a little bit more popular. My book was already out. This is 1977. They couldn't reach me, but they reached Steve. And the net result was Steve Kirk being on air with Tom Snyder, so go for it. And there's Steve Kirk kind of explaining and talking, so you see Spirit of 76 in the background. Go. Go. And the better pictures actually appeared in Playmeter years ago, showing the game. So it was a nice segment. All right. I needed to do something just to kind of pay homage to the first game I ever designed. This did not make it necessarily into the book. I think we did the back glass, but we didn't do anything else. And it was like, all right, fine. And again, it was before I ever had a chance to do Sharpshooter. But I wanted to show everybody Sky Jump. This was actually the real game down in Greenwich Village and a record/head shop where you walked in and behind the rows of stuff, he had three pinball machines that were, of course, being operated illegally at that time. I discovered the place, and Sky Jump became a game that I loved. Go. So Playfield kind of looks a little bit familiar with the lanes over there and whatever else. I know that there's no jet bumpers on the bottom, but just the whole idea of having a bank of targets like that was incredibly appealing to me. Next. So if we would have known about Stick'Em, and there's two shots here. If we would have known that you could do something, that would have made life a lot easier because I could have stuck the ball. Anything that you see in the book that we kept, and there's a whole volume of other pictures, Jim would be standing up. I'd have a ball cradled, and then it would be like, all right, are you ready? All right, I'm going to go hit the five target or the six or whatever else, see if you can capture it while it's moving. That's how we did it back then. Go. So, there it is again. Next. There it is to finish off the bank. So again, I mean, for whatever it's worth, and of course I bounced over, but go. I don't want Josh to think I had real skills. Humpty Dumpty. Interestingly, when we got to France, the Williams distributor had just an incredible showroom. And there was a second floor of corporate offices. And the third floor was like this attic. And up in the attic was rows upon rows of shelves. And if you take a look at some of the pictures we have in there, and a lot of them didn't make the cut, there was just, we spent two full days there with me taking out back glasses, putting them down. I had like a black velvet thing so we could have some background. This is just on the floor of just back glasses. I mean, literally hundreds upon hundreds of back glasses. Some of them corresponded to play fields and cabinets that they had. Many of them were just there. It was almost like archiving it. So Humpty Dumpty, obvious reasons, sitting pretty. Hawaiian Beauty. And a lot of these I brought because I know that a lot of people always have interest in looking at what the games were like, and I try to pick things from different eras. Again, we did a heck of a lot of photography of a number of different games. So now, next was the idea of, and if you remember what I said about the outline, am I doing okay? Did my watch stop at five after? Oh, Okay. All right, so I have 25 minutes? Good. Thank you. One of the things that I had in my outline was I wanted to show places, the diversity of places. And again, if you look at the book, you'll see things in laundromats, liquor stores. I mean, just absurd, strange places. One of the other things was, and I know guys on the West Coast in terms of New Pike and whatever else over by Long Beach remember these places that they grew up visiting. And maybe many of you have the same remembrances of places that are no longer around. So I just wanted to bring a few little signs of things to show you that we had a broad array of things. So Wizard's World Arcade, this was down in Ocean City, Maryland. The Game Room, this is actually in California. Time Out. Beats me, probably Ohio or someplace. But that was a chain. Time Out was there along with Aladdin's Castles. Those are really the first two mall game room chains that exist back in the mid to late 70s. Next. Time Out? Yeah. And Aladdin's Castles was ultimately owned by Bally. Again, something that didn't make the cut, but just as I was talking about before, and if we could find milk for $1.69 a gallon, wouldn't that be great, let alone a 12-ounce loaf of bread. But, I mean, you have to understand, the world that we have now with pinball is just so remarkably different. I mean, we have collectors, enthusiasts, people have games in their homes, and you're hard-pressed to find places that are out in the real world. You just are. The array and diversity of what existed back then was just incredible, and all we did was we captured basically a time capsule. So these kinds of things are just the oddities. No one would ever believe that somebody would have a pinball machine and a little superette. Go. And the other thing that I always wanted to do, and I think it's probably why the book has endured, not for the words necessarily, but so much, again, for James and what he took, it was the people. I wanted to show as much of an array of people who played pinball, guys, gals, children, grandparents, whoever it was. I wanted to show to the world that here is something that is truly unique, truly magical, and something that spans generations. And there's Challenger as a two-player game, so whoever this guy was, it's like, hi, go. Of course, a husband and wife, and obviously he's holding on to a purse while she plays. We only had so much space and room in the book, but there's many, many other pictures like this that are just like, oh my God, that looks like really interesting, and I liked a lot of these, but again, we had to be very deliberate. Just again, a lineup of games in some small place, the photograph booth in the back, and forgetting about the styles, there's just a whole little array of folks. Go. I liked always the close-ups. I always liked to see people's expression. To see, you know, I mean, look at her, both of them. It's all, you know, they're mesmerized. They don't know what's going on. I mean, but what a thrill that had to be. That experience for that moment, capturing it at that precise second. Yeah, next. Of course, we've all felt that way, whether or not we've ever expressed it as such. Needed to show the pain and the agony of defeat. Loved it. Again, excuse me, same thing. Showing the socialization of pinball and the fact that so many people could play, that does look like a high deal, but we don't have to get into the minutia. Next. Yes. I mean, that to me is the essence of what it's all about. It's what David and I talked about earlier and what Steve Epstein would have talked about if he were here. It's exposing young children to playing pinball, and that young child right now is close to middle age, which is frightening, making me feel that much older. Next, quick. This is just one, and I know that she's in the book. She was just, I mean, she was something else. But just to show an array and a lineup of games and people all intently playing, I mean, this is something that we don't find that often anymore, unless you have friends over to your house. I love this. All right. True story, just as an aside. This is at Champaign, Illinois. It's on State. Josh? Green Street, thank you. There was an arcade that was probably a few blocks away from where the campus was. And during that same visit, when I was doing the interview, we stopped by this arcade, and I never liked Jack in the Box or Jumping Jack. I mean, the bottom was too open and whatever else. They had turned this into a machine that was pristine, and when we told them what we were doing, introduced ourselves, wait, I got to call a friend of mine. He's going to come over. I think he was actually the tech. Like 10 minutes later, this guy comes in wearing this shirt, and it's like, okay, he is a freak for that game. When I had a chance a number of years later to get a Fireball, which at that time was going for about $1,500, they had just gotten some back from Germany. I know it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but go back 40 years, $1,500 for a game was significant. Everything else was, you know, a couple of hundred for a used game. I asked if they had a Jack in the Box because I was enthralled. When I played that game with that fellow, it was like, oh, I get it. I understand it. I have one now. I know that Josh has one. It's become a very nice prized possession. Next. And to show you that other people were doing things, Super Shooter. For those who were around back then, the Bally Tournament in 1978 at the Playboy Towers in downtown Chicago. 1 million players competing at Aladdin's Castles around the country. The top 20 from the various little regions of the country were flown to Chicago to play in the finals. They were broadcast on all the national stations. It was incredible. 11 to 32 was the age range with one woman. The games there were 8-ball, and there was blackjack. And a fellow by the name of Paul Ferris, who some of you may or may not know, came in at the very tail end of everything with a still wet back glass for Playboy because part of the premise was to unveil the new Playboy machine at that time, and not the subsequent ones that have been done, but the original. Bill Murray, Gilda Radner, Walter Payton, a whole slew of other celebrities were there as well. It was truly a remarkable event. It is the first time in my life I ever signed an autograph. I'm standing next to Walter Payton. I helped do the play-by-play. There was a local DJ here who kind of raised his level of, I guess, popularity and success, Gary Meyer, who was also, in quotes, one of the hosts for us to talk. And somebody came up to me to ask me for my autograph. And I remember turning to Sweetness, to Walter Payton. I said, what are you signing? And he says, I signed Sweetness 34. And it's like, okay, well, I'll try to come up with something. And I came up with something that I tend to use even now. But again, Super Shooter was an amazing event. Yeah. Again, some more pictures, a little bit out of focus. My apologies. Spinball. Oh, it is in focus. Good. Next. Some of the details, some of the work. I know that everybody always likes seeing. This is kind of like going down memory lane in terms of what the art was like and all the rest of it. Next. Interesting game, obviously. I forget what that one was, but Olympic? Thank you. Yes, you're right. So, just another outtake. All right. Chicago Coin at one time was doing some large flippers, and I thought that people would appreciate and enjoy the large flippers. So there's a couple of shots of that. Go. Because I know that didn't make the book. It just seemed too bizarre when we were looking at it and we blew it up on the sheet. But I've always thought that's kind of interesting. Next. And the same, and again, it's me flipping high. We'll get the ball save. Criterium 75, something I know that everybody is really familiar with. But again, it's one of those European companies, and go for it. So there's a segment, sequence of some, oh, maybe not. Oh, the thicker ones, okay. Safari, just some beautiful artwork from a bygone era. Next. Guys and Dolls from Gottlieb. I just love the artwork from the 40s and 50s when you still had just, you know, the old wood rails. Cupid Doll. Paul Bunyan, again, with its six flippers. Next. I thought that that would be intriguing to see. There's a close-up of my hand rolling a ball on a play field. Because we were talking about illegal games and whatever else, this is another one of those roll-through games. It wasn't necessarily because of any legal restriction with no plunger allowed or whatever else. That was just the way the game was designed back whenever. But I always liked the cabinetry and everything else. I always thought it was beautiful, and I liked the back glass on that. Next. Criterium, I guess we did do it. It was just my fault out of sequence. Interesting with three captive balls, and Criterium was bicycling was the theme. Next. There it is, bicycling as the theme. So we did series of pictures that were like this. We do a back glass, we do a play field, we do a full-on shot, three-quarter, and then we'd kind of go through the process. Typically, what would happen, this is a good place to stop. Typically, what would happen, James would position himself. I'll do it here without breaking my neck. I would get up on a chair because of overhead lighting, glare, and whatever else, and I'd have like a black felt. And I would travel and take that around and stand on chairs, stand wherever I could to block out things so that we could get the best look possible. Next. Another close-up. My arms by then were probably shredded. Next. All right. I thought this would be interesting. This did not make the book. It's talked about in text. I thought that we were going to have somebody else that was going to be appearing tomorrow night, and I thought that he might have appreciated this. Dynamite was from Allied Leisure. It is the first game that was, in quotes, electronic and just regular electromechanical. And at that point in time, the big thing was, go next, was Jimmy Walker, Dynamite. So this was a game, I mean, basic layout. If you take a look at it, you'd really think it's almost like a Gottlieb game, forgetting about the level of the artwork. But you had four drop targets just kind of primed right there to block everything. You know, real basic design from this period of time, which was 1975. This actually predated the Mirko game that came out as the, in quotes, first solid state. They were based out of Arizona or someplace from what my memory is. Next. For those who were not aware of the fact that Allied Leisure actually did a number of different games back then. Dynamite was the first, forgetting about Shaker Ball and Spooksville and whatever else that they did, which was in an upright calendar. Think of Varcon, but a little bit different in terms of just the era. And Varcon, I think, is on the floor as it is every year, and you'll see it. It's what Williams did a number of years back when we were looking to try to come up with a configuration, just as an industry, to fit pinball into what a video game footprint was. So Thunderbolt was game number two, and then for all of you guys that loved Hootenanny and everything else, Roy Clark was their third and actually their last game that they wound up doing. But again, I mean, very basic kind of games. You can see the same kind of yellow targets that are over here that they had used before, almost in the same place, Highway F4. It's blocking, it's doing whatever. But again, I thought it was kind of interesting to kind of show that. Next. Just another mood shot for whatever it was worth. Evil. I like this just because I like the game. And it's a game that I actually wound up getting from Bally for a project that I worked on. So, Air Aces, I know, is one of Josh's favorites. Great game. I think a guy by the name of Jim Patla might have worked on that just a tad. Yep. But it was, and again, it was a tribute, if you will, to Jack in the Box and whatever else and some of the other games that had similar configurations. But if you take a look, it's the same premise that I just kind of opened before with Captain Fantastic. I needed playfield shots like this that we could put in, and we just ran out of room. Next. This is in the book. I thought that Dave Christensen's work back at the time was just brilliant. I just loved what he was able to capture. And, you know, we used to talk about the artwork being reminiscent and being really influenced by a time frame of Terry and the Pirates, which the majority of you probably don't know, but it's the old comic book cartoon type of styling that was very rich, very depth and dimensional. Next. All right, so there was a point in time when pinball had kind of metamorphosized into being this very desirable product for the home. What a strange coincidence. Fast forward, and it is again now. Mattel actually did 5 minutes. All right, Mattel actually did a full-size game called Vegas. They never made it into commercial production. Harry Williams was brought in by Brunswick to do game design and development. I flew out to meet with Harry in Palm Springs and was going to be working with him before things kind of blew up with them. But this is from some of their advertising or whatever else. Downsize game. Boom. Go. Those are some of the games and some of Harry's designs at what he was doing. Fully electric. I mean, not like a Zizzle game. Go. The last picture in the book is a picture of a game called Temptation, which was from Sega. This was the other game that was also in their private suite that we had access to. And I always liked this one, too, although Temptation really kind of captured everything. And then the last slide, how else could I help but end it that way? Thanks, everybody. I know that I have about 2 seconds. Any questions or anything else? I didn't cover half the stuff I wanted to, but it's okay. Anything, or we're good? Al.
Something with the game plan?
Game plan, yes. Cocktail pinball machines that Game Plan did, yes. I mean, that's how things kind of started with me and Game Plan, and I guess at some other point in time we can talk about it. Did everybody kind of enjoy this? Was this okay, or?
Yeah.
Huh? Oh, wait.
Hey, guys, I just want to mention one thing from an older player, collector, and so forth. I remember when Roger's book came out, we just couldn't get enough of going through page by page. His viewpoint was so different at the time, and we were hungry for a book. There was Colmer. Was Colmer before you? Was before you, I think?
Colmer basically did a book that was
Michael Colmer's book and Harry McGowan. Harry McGowan's book, a fellow I think out of Canada, was before me. It wasn't before me in terms of when I started. I said at the very beginning that I was meeting with all the publishers. Nobody said no to what I wanted to do. The only differential was how I wanted to do it. I wanted photography. I wanted to travel everywhere and catch people. I wanted interviews. Harry's book is great. It's a lot of pictures and very minimal editorial. Michael Colmer's book is basically a reprint of flyers. So both of those books came out before mine, but mine came out soon after. So
there was, we were so hungry for materials. That's why when this came out, it was just a godsend. And I remember there was a little pamphlet or whatever you want to call it, a little booklet came out from the Regina Public Library. And I don't know, it was about 10 pages. It was a gallery they had. It was a photograph of some of the games in the gallery. So that was something. We couldn't get anything anywhere. So just to have Roger stuff was so refreshing, and we would go through that page, so awful. We just couldn't get enough of it. It was just so great. This guy is so great because he started with this, and he's so doggone humble, which makes it even better. And then he designs games. He comes to Expo. He's what we call the full package. And what's bad about that is he's every woman's dream, every man's nightmare. And he's been so great for Expo. And I think, listen, if you have a few more questions until Gary shows up here, let's just keep the questions going.
Yeah, I mean, does anybody have anything that they want to ask or curious about? Yeah.
You say there's a lot of material that didn't make it.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how your contract was. Do you still have that material in this day and age, micro-publishing?
The question was if you guys didn't hear it, whether or not I still have all the material that didn't exist, the original manuscript, pictures, and whatever else. Do I have the rights? Do I control everything? The answer is yes, yes, and yes. Has there been discussions over the years for me to do a reprint? Yes. Has there been discussion years back? Rob was even part of it. So was Mr. Shellberg. We'll do whatever we can. Do a second book. And I think the problem is twofold. One, I can't talk about it like right now, but let's say when their interest was 20 years ago. All right, so there's only a 20-year lag, let's say, from the publishing of the first book. The problem was not only because my boys were younger and you have other responsibilities and whatever else, but the only way I would do it is the same way. And people said, no, just reprint the flyers in the back. Just add an addendum. Just do whatever. And it's just, I can't compromise it. So I still have all the stuff. I think Josh and Zach, and I know that Gary just got here, so I'll try to wrap it up. I know that they've talked about doing some things maybe when I'm gone without my permission. So depending on how long I last, you guys may find something. I know that Josh has even had some discussions and have talked about, I have all of the cassettes. I have all the interviews. And as he has said, God, wouldn't it be great to actually hear Harry Williams' voice? Nobody's ever heard it. Wouldn't it be great to hear Sam Ginsberg, Bill Gersh, Bill DeSalm? I mean, and the list kind of goes on and on and on. So maybe there'll be something that way, not necessarily self-published, micro-published, or whatever else. Hey, guys, thanks. I'm sorry. My time is cut off.